place for that now. Yeah. Now they want to tear it up. Well, that's not
going to be too hard. Yeah. It's all in the
It's also funny, too. It's like they're taking parking off Main Street. Oh, my God. Living Cop builds Frontier Plaza. Everybody moves out because the city's going to die. We're putting parking back on. Oh, my God. Same story.
I'd like to call the Carson City Board of Equalization meeting Tuesday, January 21st, 2014, to order. Call to order and determination quorum, please.
Chairperson Block?
Here.
Vice Chairperson Bagwell?
Present.
Member Asner?
Here.
Member Schultz?
Here.
Member Simmons?
Here.
The quorum's present.
Thank you. Randy, should we do the swearing in as part of the orientation when we get to item number C? Is that how we want to cover that to talk about it? What we're going to do this year. Yes. Okay. On to item number B, public comment. The public is invited at this time to comment on and discuss any topic that is relevant to or within the authority of the Carson City Board of Equalization that is not on the agenda. Do we have any public? All right, no public. Item C, Carson City Board of Equalization members orientation, Chief Deputy District Attorney Randy Munn, Assessor Dave Dolly, and Assessor's Office staff.
That one works.
Oh, you need to get the technical guys to come in with that. So as far as gathering as a quorum, that is the danger zone for you as public board members. If you gather in any type of media or if you gather in person, it's still a gathering. And if you gather as a quorum, the question is, what are you doing in that quorum? Are you socializing, which is perfectly legal, or are you talking about the business of the board? When you talk about the business of the board in more than a quorum or in a quorum or more, then you run into problems with the open meeting law and create suspicion of individuals who might question your motives. So the best thing to do is make sure that if you gather as a quorum socially, that it's clear to everyone that it's a social event, just so that people don't jump to conclusions. You need to keep in mind the issue of serial communication as the law defines it, and that is what has evolved in case law as being individuals that gather in smaller groups, but what they're really doing is gathering as a meeting in little bits and chunks with the intent that that's what they're planning to do. For serial communications that require specific intent to be wrong, but it's very easy to do it by accident. The easiest way to do it by accident is by email. And so I always advise the Board of Supervisors and the boards that I represent that if the board is going to communicate about issues that's within their purview by email, you're entitled under the law to lobby. There's a safe harbor that you can go to any board member and lobby their position on anything that's before the board. Where it becomes that serial communication is when you go to this person and you tell them why you think you should vote this way, and then you go to Jed and you say, if it's Jill doing this, she's saying, well, Lori said, Jed, are you with us? As soon as you start tying in what other people have thought about the issue and you connect up three, you've got a quorum. As soon as you cross that line, you're allegedly violating the open meeting law. And it needs to be something to keep mindful, because what happens is if you pop off an email to everyone and someone chimes in and another person chimes in at the exact same time and you don't realize there's three of you already communicating on a subject, and you've created basically a prima facie case for the Attorney General to say three people are in this email thread and they're communicating about a subject before the board. That's kind of the inadvertent violation that can happen. The way to avoid that, I recommend to the Board of Supervisors and to everyone else, is when the board wants to ask the board member something, which they could do if they were lobbying, that you use the blind carbon copy, blind CC to all the members. So essentially you do an email to yourself and BC everyone else. That way, if they reply all, it doesn't go to all. It just comes back to you. Because the risk is that you hit reply all really fast, especially in the heat of the moment. And that way you can avoid that, and you still preserve your right to communicate one-on-one with each individual and not violate the law. Okay, that puts me on page three. The legislature last session actually defined the word deliberate. They pretty much adopted it from the case law and put it in the statutes, which basically says it means to collectively examine, to weigh and reflect upon the reasons for or against the action. The term includes without limitation the collective discussion or exchange of facts preliminary to the ultimate decision. So deliberation when you hear a matter, you deliberate, each one of you do. You can, in your mind, you're deliberating, you're ruminating over the evidence you've heard or the issues that are before you. That is a form of deliberation, but not an illegal form. You can deliberate, ruminate, think about, and analyze stuff with another person in the course of lobbying someone. It's almost unavoidable. What you can't do, as I say, is to take the information from this person and carry it to the third person so that three of you are kind of coming to the same page. So, I mean, if you lobby someone, you're going to lobby them on the issue. You're going to have an idea of what they think about it. You go to the next person, you have an idea of what they think about it. You go to the next person, you have an idea. That is legal. It's when you try to collect everyone together and communicate what other people are thinking to try and improve your position with one person. I say, well, you know, you don't want to be the third man out, right? That's where the caution is, and that where the deliberation crosses the line. For this board, obviously, the majority is a simple majority. You're not an elected body, so it would be a simple majority to a quorum. Obviously, to meet is at least three of you, and if at least three of you show up, we can do business. But it's going to take a simple majority of those three to do anything as far as action, and so obviously that's two. I've discussed social functions, actions. What constitutes action? When you actually make a decision, when you arrive at a consensus, when there's some commitment made or a promise made, those are all forms of action that the law would recognize as action taken. And so all that type of action needs to be done in a public forum, an open meeting. And you can see through serial communication how you could arrive at a consensus or a commitment or a promise through serial communication if you wanted to. And the case law has, you know, pinpointed circumstances where it's happened. And obviously the law does not allow that to happen. Okay, I'm moving to page four. If you have any ethics issues regarding a matter that appears for this board, when you make that disclosure and you abstain, the law allows the quorum to shift as if you weren't there, so that you know, you're not penalized. The board is not penalized because of you doing something ethical. Keep in mind the ethical matters. If you have any questions regarding ethical matters before you'll see some on the agenda and say, oh, I'm not feeling comfortable about that, please give me a call and we can talk about it and decide together whether you should abstain and what the process you should follow. All of you have probably been on other boards. You're familiar with that issue. But if you have any questions along the way, just call me and we can talk about it. You may have noticed our agenda. Public comments are a little different in format. And I also did this with the Board of Supervisors. And this is the same format we're using for them. It really is to make it so objective that anybody picks this up sitting in the crowd can say, all right, I have at least two opportunities where I can have public comment. And I know at least on one of them, in this case under F, that I can talk about any matter, no matter whether it's on the agenda or not. And so that makes it crystal clear. And then it double asterisks down to some boilerplate of limitations with the aspirational goal that if it's appropriate by the board that you can call for individual item public comment, because any limitations to public comments, the law requires that it be expressly provided for in your agenda. So just that format change so you understand why we did that. Moving to page five, just a quick refresher, agendas are posted 3 working days before the meeting. So the staff is furiously putting together the agendas, the agenda items, the documents they're going to need. It becomes challenging to get that all done. The law is not clear as to what is reasonable notice for the appellant regarding the hearing. We've traditionally followed the open meeting law. You know, there's issues that could be raised whether that minimum 3 days is sufficient. I think staff tries to get them out as soon as they can, but ultimately we will comply with the minimum that the law requires, that objectively requires. Do you have any comments on that? Okay. Emergency agendas. The law is that you don't get to do an emergency agenda with the less than 3 days notice unless there's, literally an emergency. And the law is specific regarding fire, earthquake, flood, you know, a declared emergency. It's such a narrow exception that I've only seen it come up like 2 or 3 times in my entire career. And as far as closing meetings, I don't anticipate that we would need to close any meetings. I haven't seen it done in the years that I've represented this board. The law provides for the closing of a meeting in certain circumstances to consider the character, misconduct, or competence or physical mental health of a person. And there's a whole bunch of gymnastics you have to go through to comply with the open meeting law for a closed session. And I don't anticipate us needing to do that, so I'll skip to page 7. The minutes of the board meeting are kept electronically. They're very important in this body because this is an evidentiary body for the State Board of Equalization. The open meeting law only requires the substance of matters to be basically brought in by the clerk from the notes, and then there's a tape. The tape is retained for a year, and the actual notes of the meeting are, or the minutes are, retained for 5 years. In our case, this entire record gets rolled up and packaged and sent to the State Board of Equalization if there's any appeals of the decisions of this board. Keep in mind that as members of a public body, you are absolutely privileged in the matters that you say while you're on the record in these meetings. And witnesses before this body are privileged from any defamation as long as they are not knowingly misrepresenting. Swearing them under oath places individuals under the evidentiary requirements of the state law regarding equalization matters, and that's a whole separate issue if they engage in falsehoods there. Enforcement of this law is primarily the Attorney General. She has exclusive jurisdiction. I've never seen her punt to like a DA to handle it. She could theoretically in the right circumstances. So she has primary jurisdiction. She has 60 days in which to act, in which to void an action of a board that was done in violation of the open meeting law. The legislature added some new circumstances that encourages boards to self-fix as quickly as possible, and basically says that if a board makes a mistake on the open meeting law, they recognize their mistake, they have 30 days to basically self-fix it. And if they do that, it tolls the Attorney General's time in which she can act, but it also gives her the discretion to decide that it's in the public's best interest not to prosecute. And that was intentionally, having been at the AG's office for many years and supervised this function at that end. The goal is compliance. It's always been compliance, not persecution or prosecution. And so It is the philosophy of the Attorney General to encourage that. So I can't imagine a circumstance where you self-fix yourself and then she prosecutes you. I just can't see that happening. And one thing to keep in mind in a self-fix, it's you can't retroactively fix what you screwed up the first time. So if you have a time-sensitive matter and you make a mistake on open meeting law and your action is going to end up being void, if you notice the matter in 30 days for the fix, it's not going to be retroactive to the first mistake. It'll be when you fix it. And so enforcement, Attorney General has a whole body of law, of open meeting law opinions that are on her website. I oftentimes refer to those when I have tight circumstances to try and say, well, this is the way they've interpreted in the past. I use that kind of like a common law to help us advise you regarding circumstances of the open meeting law. And unless you have any questions, that's a basic overview of the things you need to know. Thank you. Now, are we going to the assessor's office?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave Dolly, Carson City Assessor. Last year, we had a really nice presentation by the Department of Taxation as far as the equalization process. Nothing has changed, really, and so, therefore, we're not really going to do an orientation for you. However, they did have legislature did go in session, and they didn't do any changes, really, to the property tax system. And so we have nothing to cover there. We're going to try and streamline a little bit this year. And if you'll notice, one of the comments from last year was you don't like the laptops, so you have no laptops. And so if there's anything that we can do to help you with this process, please let us know. We will do anything we can. And if you have any suggestions on how we can streamline the process, please let us know. Again, we'll do anything we can to do it.
Mr. Chairman, it might be appropriate to talk about the oath thing at this point. With the State Board of Equalization, their regulations require that the proceedings before this board be under oath. And the guidelines they've sent down physically actually give us an oath and a procedure in which to do it. Essentially, the way it would work is before in any item where you're going to take testimony, like the next item, that anybody that is intending to testify before both sides would stand up, and then I would stand up and swear them on under oath that the information they're going to provide is truthful. Essentially, occasionally, the chair could remind the person that they're under oath. And if they were a new person that stood up and weren't in the original oath, that we'd have to swear them at that time. So we just kind of have to manage that process a little bit and keep track of how we've done that, so that when it gets to a state board appeal, they're relying on our record as the factual record under oath. And we haven't had an issue in years that fell upon the veracity of the information brought before this board. To my knowledge, we haven't gone through this formality, but it doesn't hurt to do it, and it's best that we comply so that formality is in place in case they get something at the state board and there's a factual dispute over whether someone's being truthful.
So, with that said, so that would need to be on the agenda, correct? Would that need to be agendized after, say, public comment before we hear any of the possible action items that anybody that's going to be testifying to swear them in at that time, or swear them in as each individual action item comes upon us?
Yeah, it would just be part of the action item. When the item came up, as in when you call the item 4D, item D for the exemption, then I would ask all those in intend to testify on that matter, both the assessor's office and the appellant to stand up. I would give the oath. They sit down, and then the case would proceed.
Okay, fair enough. Any questions? Okay, item D for possible action. Thank you, Mr. Dolly and Randy.
Can I do a disclosure? Okay. Should I do my disclosure first?
Yeah. On to item D for possible action, determination of exempt status for Friends of Service Helping, 430 Janelle Drive, APN 001-032-34. A member of the board would like to have a would like to disclose her affiliation.
Lori Bagwell, for the record, I'd like to disclose that I am the current chairman of FISH. And so I'd like to disclose that, and so I won't vote on this issue. Even though there's no personal gain, I'll just take the high road and not vote on this issue.
Thank you, Mrs. Bagwell. Randy, would you like to swear in the assessor's office in our...
If I could have everyone that intends to testify on this matter, the appellant, and I will swear you into under oath. Do each of you swear or affirm the testimony you will give in this matter will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth under penalty of perjury?
Yes.
Let the record show that all the proposed persons who will testify in this matter have acknowledged under oath.
Thank you. Now, how do you want to proceed with to have the appellant come up and talk about his application? Or with the...
Thank you, Member Block, Chairman Block. Kimberly Adams with the Carson City Assessor's Office. I'd like to identify the property for the appellant. This is parcel number 001-032-34. The property is located at 430 Janelle Drive, owned by FISH.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Peckham, would you like to come up and talk to us? Please state your name for the record.
Jim Peckham, Executive Director of FISH, or Friends in Service Helping, and a whole lot of other words that go with our formal title. We have obviously existing property that has been deemed as tax-deferred, given the social services we provide and our status as a 501c3. And we're fortunate to have some property donated to us, which is the 430 Janelle. We actually took ownership of it in August. So we, according to normal procedures, we need to put in a request for exemption prior to June, and we couldn't do that since we didn't have the property yet. When we received the property, it had one renter, so-and-so, and then we had there was a nonprofit, Literacy Volunteers, who was not paying rent to the former owners. Once we took it over, I think we got 2 months' worth of rent from so-and-so, and then they've decided to move out, and we've maintained the Literacy Volunteers at rent-free. Knew for some time that we'd be had the potential, or at least had the commitment of receiving that property. So prior to receiving it, we talked about it as a board with our board of directors and put together a plan and a determination of how to use the property. And again, it would be incorporating a lot of the same sorts of things with some expanded services from FISH. Even prior to taking ownership, we started to use it to help us process donations that came into our thrift store. Our plan is to continue to do that so we can clean up our thrift store and have all donations go out at that location. And then also, as we've had in a couple of different newspaper articles, the plan is to put in a transitional mental health and then be able to provide some OJT with some of the processes of receiving some of the goods that get donated to our thrift stores and cleaning them up and making them ready, store ready, to be able to ship out to one of our three thrift stores. And then the third thing that we've talked about, in addition with the literacy volunteers, is to make space available to other nonprofits. We've done a number of things to try and bring collaboration between the nonprofits and the partners that we have. We've got a new database that is on the cloud so that we can share information about clients more effectively and be able to do planning and whatnot. So we're trying to do more and more to be able to bring that collaboration. And then we've been meeting with, I've been meeting with different organizations, the Health and Human Services, State Mental Health, the hospital, and a number of the sheriff and the folks at the jail and others to try and discuss the significant need that exists for transitional mental health. We're all in concurrence that that's something that needs to move forward. I've gotten a verbal approval already for funding of the project. Now we just have to finalize the design and pinpoint the contractual costs. And at that point in time, I'll bring it back to my board for final approval so we can start the construction process to make the facility functional for those purposes. Any questions?
Great. Any questions for the appellant? Mr. Susser, would you like to continue on?
Thank you, Chairman Block. Again, my name is Kimberly Adams with the Carson City Assessor's Office. As Mr. Peckham has explained, they took ownership of the property on August 27th, which is past the statutory deadline to apply for the exemption. That is why we are bringing this item to you today. The application was received by our office on October 1st, and it is our opinion that they do, in fact, qualify for the exemption as long as the property meets the exact usage of that property. That is our concern right now. If you look at page 12 and page 14, of their exemption application, there's a little bit of conflicting information. The Board of Directors has determined a use of traditional housing and donation drop-off location, and Mr. Peckham had initialed that they've determined to use it for mental health, but then on item D, it states that they will update the building for transitional housing. The final board decision still needs to be made. Whether or not you feel that affects the application for their exemption to be approved for the 13-14 year, of course, is entirely up to you. That will have to be verified before our office can approve their 14-15 exemption. I'd also like the record to note that there is a correction on page 26. For the amounts of the taxes to be removed. Because there are a percentage of the building being occupied by two other leases, those amounts have to be subtracted out of the proration if approved for the exemption. Where it says less taxable portion under the column for amount to remove, instead of $947.21, that amount should be $1,157.68. Changing the overall refund amount under the less taxable portion to $973.19. In the paragraph above, we had stated that the taxable portion was 9%. It's actually 11%. In addition, you were presented with late evidence. We received the application from Carson City Literacy Volunteers on January 14th. This was after we had completed the packets, and that does change the proration of the tax bill for the 13-14 year. The application for Carson City Literacy Volunteers seems to be in order. Deputy District Attorney Randy Munn has also reviewed the application, and it is the opinion of both the assessor's office and the DA's office that they do, in fact, qualify for the exemption as well. If the board determines to approve the application for FISH, it is our recommendation that they also approve the application for exemption for Carson City Literacy Volunteers for the 13-14 year. And that would obviously affect the amount of the adjustment to the taxes. And the assessor's office has no recommendation at this time. Our concern, again, is just the usage of the building.
Okay, thank you. I have a question about if the nonprofit owns it and they're a 501c, and they're leasing it out to a 501c, that would be different if they were leasing it out to a profit corporation?
That is correct, as long as the 501c that is leasing also applies for an exemption. Unfortunately, just because you're a 501c3 exempt entity, that doesn't mean you're exempt from taxation. The statutes are very specific, and they would have to qualify as well.
Okay, so the part of the parcel that that tenant is occupying, if they do not apply, then they're still, the nonprofit that owns it still has to pay the tax on that,
that
space that's being used.
That is correct. And I'd also like to let you know that our office has other properties that are owned by exempt entities that allow taxable entities to occupy portions of those properties. And each year we re-verify the exemption portion for those entities, and that would be something that we would do for FISH as well, because each year things obviously are going to change and already has since they've taken ownership. So we're going to re-verify that percentage. That square footage may decrease, may increase, so forth. So we re-verify that on an annual basis before the upcoming tax year.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
Yeah, I have a question on 13A. On page 14, he has specified that the building was unoccupied when they acquired. When was so-and-so in the building paying rent? Was it empty at this time on the 1st of October, or was this carried on? When did so-and-so vacate the building?
They formally vacated at the end of November. Collected rent a couple times. We knew that they were leaving. They didn't have a lease in place with a former owner, and we were working with them to try and get a lease in place, and they basically told us they were not interested in having a lease, would rather leave.
So the property was occupied, not unoccupied.
When we first acquired the property, yes. So-and-so had been there for years and years under the old ownership, as well as for a couple of months under our ownership. Okay. And Literacy Volunteers, though, have never had a lease and have never paid any rent to the prior or to us. And I don't know if that makes any difference. We talk about leasee, but they're not leasing from us. They're just...
No, I was just questioning because it said it was unoccupied at the time you filled this form out, which it was not unoccupied.
On page 9, we indicate that so-and-so was there. And so on what page are you saying that it was unoccupied? Yeah, that blank was misworded, because at that time so-and-so was still in that particular property, and as was Literacy Volunteers.
and that so-and-so was there until the end of November.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you.
So just for clarification, was there part of the building that didn't have anybody in it? There was part of it was vacant. So
probably three-quarters of the building was, or maybe even.
Okay, so
it's probably 85-90% of the facility was vacant.
Okay, because when I the way I read 13A, it says, are there any unoccupied? So part of the whole was, the whole thing was not occupied.
No, I understand that.
Yeah, members of the board, there are two actual separate buildings. So I think
there's
when they were
three,
answering
actually.
Three,
we show two,
including the garage. Are you?
There's three separate buildings. One was built, I think, in 74, the other one in 79, and they've got a little adjoining, walkway or something between the two of them. And then the other one was built, I think, in the early 80s.
Okay. So I think
the L shape is actually two separate buildings.
Big tax is one.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think with the question 13A, it's asking the other buildings on the property if they are occupied.
Maybe.
And
perfect. Thanks for the clarification. Are there any other questions for the appellant or the assessor's office from the board?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have questions for both. For the assessor's office first, has there been any property taxes paid up to this point so far?
Yes, there has.
And paid by who?
The prior owner and also Fish.
Okay, that was my next question. Because Fish took control of this property on August 27th, but the first installment was due on the 19th. So the previous owner, Janelle LLC?
Correct.
They paid that first installment?
It would have been paid through escrow. Right. And so any refunds that would be due, if approved today, that is handled through the treasurer's office, and they would refund the appropriate entities who paid those actual taxes.
So that you mean the previous owner, Janelle?
The previous owner or the current owner. Because it was recommended at the time that Fish received their application, we always encourage that they still make the payments for the tax bill so that no penalties are accrued.
I understand that.
Okay.
But my point is the previous owner is liable for the property taxes up to that point of the sale.
But that would have been handled through escrow.
Right.
Okay. So why would we want to refund them?
Well, by the per statute, we have to prorate the taxes. Okay. So we're going to take from the time that Janelle LLC owned the property from July 1st of 2013 through August 27th, and they will be liable for that portion.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Do we have any other questions? I'd like to entertain a motion. Randy, just for clarification, sitting as the chairman cannot propose a motion, can they?
You could certainly craft one and someone could just ditto it?
Okay. I'll try to craft a motion for the board here. I move that the Board of Equalization approves the exemption for fish for the fiscal, for the 2013-2014 year, and that also recommends that the Assessor's Office application for the Carson City Literacy Volunteers be approved as well for the fiscal 2013-2014 fiscal year.
Anybody want to adopt that motion as it was read? Make that motion?
About late evidence.
Including and also the admission of the late evidence.
So that motion, that crafted motion, would also include the late evidence as presented to us. Would anybody on the board like to adopt that proposed motion?
I move to accept the proposed motion.
I'll second it.
Okay, now do we have any questions on the motion? Do we need any clarification? Did we get everything covered? Okay, those all in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries, and that Lori abstains from the motion. All right, now for item number E for possible action. Next meeting date, February 14th, 2014. Mr. Dolly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, the next meeting would be February 4th at 10 o'clock here. And I'll go into public comment at that time.
Okay, so do we need to make, we don't need to take action on that right now, okay? Item F, public comment. The public, once again, is invited at this time to comment on any matter that is not specifically included on the agenda as an action item. No action may be taken on a matter raised under this item of the agenda. Any
Mr. public? Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Just me. Sorry. First off, I would like to thank everybody for, again, this year taking the time to volunteer your time to meet and to make sure that the equalization happens here in Carson City. I truly appreciate it. We're going to try something different this year, and we're not going to have meetings every single Tuesday. We actually did not start getting all of our appeals in until the 13th. So, I mean, we got bombarded with appeals. And so we're hoping to have only three meetings right now. We'll have one on the 4th, one on the 18th. And then if we need to, we'll have one on the 25th. But we're really shooting for the 4th and the 18th just to get done with those. For the next item, we have a couple stipulations, and we have four or five appeals that we would like to hear. But again, it shouldn't last longer than 12 noon. And we are shooting for just the two because we know that your time is very valuable, and we don't want you to have to come and sit here just for a 10 or 15 minute meeting. So anyway, again, thank you very much. I truly appreciate the fact that you're here and that you're helping us out.
Thank you, sir. And I'd also like to thank the people on the board willing to take their appointments to serve on this Board of Equalization. Item G, a motion for possible action on adjournment.
I can do that one. I move for adjournment.
Second.
I'll second it.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Motion carries.
Did you second it? I did.
These are up there.
Yeah, get your name and everything so they can see in TV land.